Good morning. Welcome to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and this week we have lots to talk about. We're going to be talking about stress. And before we start, I want to invite you to call Kate Brister, the Master Gardener in the foyer, and register for Spring Into Gardening, Spring Garden Seminar, which will be on April 17th, a Saturday. It's all day with raffle and plant sale and educational classes all day long. So give us a call here at 325-0010. My guest today is Patrick Prindle. He is a professor of psychology at Clatsop Community College, and he is back for return engagement, and we are going to talk about the social and physiologic aspects of the human stress response. And I want a little bit of an update on what's happening up the hill at the college. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there is. We're all excited up there. We're in the middle of the Jerome redevelopment project, and it looks as though things are going to be finished in time for the fall quarter. So by September of this year, we should be completely done, and the whole campus should have a brand new look. And for those out there that haven't been up to the campus yet, let me invite everyone to come up and check out the new Columbia Hall, which is just an awesome building.
Are you teaching classes in that building?
Some classes in that building, yes, and many classes are being done right now in modular units behind Columbia Hall.
Oh.
Yeah, until we get Toller reconstructed and get back in business for the fall, yeah.
Uh-huh, okay. So our topic is to find out more about stress and how we can do a better job of handling things that are feeling overwhelming or unpleasant.
Yeah, absolutely. But let me give a shout out to my students in general, and particularly the group of students who's in PSY 190, which is literally a course on stress that we offer in the psychology department at the college. It's called Stress Theory and Management. It was pioneered by my friend and colleague Florence Sage. And this is the first time I've taught it, so my students and I are kind of partnering up to to sort of get this thing going and streamline it and make it a really cool thing. So far, so good.
Oh, good. Well, so, the term is what, a month old? No. Yeah, about a month.
Yeah, we're about, actually, this is the beginning of the fifth week of the current quarter.
Okay, cool.
So, yeah.
So, do you want to give us a definition of...
Well, where I'd like to start is to sort of, one of my heroes has been for a number of years, Robert Sapolsky, who's a neurobiologist at Stanford University. And for about 11 years, I taught psychology at De Anza College in Cupertino, California, which is just literally a half an hour drive from Stanford, where Robert does his thing. So I had the distinct privilege of being able to study with him on a couple of occasions and workshops. So what I'm going to be doing today is visiting some of Sapolsky's research and research done by some other people in the field. And we're going to be looking at some, I think, exciting new findings and the implications of those findings for the kind of society we're creating and as you said, the kind of things we can do to manage stress better. Yeah.
Well, good. I mean, it seems like it's all the way from within the family to the whole society and countries interacting with each other.
Absolutely.
We could do a better job.
We could. And as it turns out, Sapolsky has been for 30 years now going to Kenya, East Africa, and working with colonies of baboons. And so the first thing I want to encourage our listening audience is to for us humans to apply some of the knowledge that's been learned from primates. We're going to look at some other studies with macaque monkeys and such as well, and some studies done in Great Britain with human subjects, all of which seem to be showing similar trends. So, and a good way to launch into this is how Robert Sapolsky does it in my favorite of his books called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. So let's just sort of imagine that we're a zebra on the savannah in Africa, and a lioness has picked us out for lunch that day. And so we start, the chase is on and we're running, and the stress response is kicked in. But the thing is that it's a real stress thing. Mm-hmm. It's life or death. And the key thing is it's acute. In other words, it has a sudden onset, a duration. It lasts for a certain length of time, and then it stops. And then, you know, we start to become a relaxed zebra again. Mm-hmm. And we go mingle with our zebra buddies and back to munching grass and now we're relaxed again. So if you think about that and then contrast that with the kind of stress that we're dealing with today, here are some of the trends. I've made some notes here about some of the trends. So over the last 100 years or so, there's been a progressive movement away from stressors that tend to be acute toward what are referred to as chronic stressors.
Those are things that don't go away.
Absolutely. They don't
necessarily. The lion is always there.
Yeah, exactly. The lion is always there. Mm-hmm. And then along with that is the lion is always there, but it isn't necessarily real. It's not a tangible lion on the outside. It's us laying awake at night worrying about the mortgage and
taxes.
Getting the kids to school and taxes and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, and that the trend has also been in terms of medicine, as you all know, that it used to be 100 years ago, most people succumbed to what? Contagious disease. And then with the onset of penicillin and advances in medicine and stuff, now, in fact, physicians and healthcare professionals talk about chronic disease a lot. So mm-hmm. chronic is kind of the trend. And along with that, again, moving from physical to more psychological stressors, moving from real, tangible, empirically mm-hmm. validatable kind of stressors to imagined or self-created stressors. And also sort of an equal access or equal opportunity kind of stressor. In other words, if you're a zebra out there, the lion may pick you out for whatever reason on any given day, to what we might look at as a social context, which particularly relates to the have and the have-not situation, which globally is becoming more and more the case.
Can you give an example?
Haves and have-nots. I can give you an example right here in Astoria. 10 years ago, you could buy a house in Astoria for $125,000 to $150,000. Now they start at about $250,000. So those that have are the ones that got into the market when it was affordable, and the have-nots are the ones that may not ever be able to get into the market or are currently trying to get in. Mm-hmm. And what we know is the difference in how we physiologically respond to stress is directly linked to whether we're a have or a have-not.
Oh.
And that's kind of one of the themes we'll be going through. So, yeah. So, in other words, there is a correlation between what I'm going to call physiological markers. And we're going to run through some of those physiological markers, the kind of changes that happen that are tangible, measurable, scientifically validatable effects on your body, and how those correlate with social status and rank, being a have-not. Where you are in the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Direct relationship. Fascinating
wow.
stuff.
That's amazing.
Yes. So what Sapolsky noticed was if you observe baboon colonies, they definitely tend to have, your typical baboon colony will have a pecking order. And the pecking order usually goes in terms of what are called alpha males. The alpha male is the biggest, baddest, meanest, aggressive baboon and establishes his dominance over the other males. And everybody in the troop literally knows where they stand in the hierarchy. So if the big bad alpha baboon's having a bad day, they may take it out on the next person in the hierarchy, and then that baboon takes it out on the next one, and on down the line. And so what Sapolsky did, he's the first that really did it starting about 30 years ago, is he actually using a blow dart gun would anesthetize these things, knock them out temporarily, and then take blood samples and do a blood panel and look at stress enzymes and stress hormones.
Of the ones that were being picked on?
Of both.
Oh,
actually.
Okay.
So in other words, he starts looking at things like, and I'm going to use some scientific terms here, but adrenaline, everybody's heard of adrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
The two primary stress hormones would be adrenaline and what are called the glucocorticoids, both of which are secreted by the adrenal glands. So in other words, if you take a blood sample, you can look at, you know, how much stress hormone activity is going on in these various members of the troop.
And
as it turns out, the lower you are in the hierarchy, the more stress hormones.
So the alpha male has the lowest level.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
So being the CEO of your company may actually put you in a better position?
Absolutely.
At least stress-wise.
Absolutely.
And although most people would say, oh, being the boss is horrible.
Exactly. And some bosses say that, too.
Lots of bosses do.
Yeah. So they make it seem as though the people lower in the hierarchy have the most stress when, in fact, it's just the opposite.
Interesting. Yeah. Uh-huh. Does that really correlate with people?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, it does.
Which is a good segue into the Whitehall study, which was done in Great Britain. As it turns out, the British civil service is set up in a very distinct social hierarchy, like 7 different levels. And so this study was done over a period of 3 or 4 decades. And they interviewed just, a lot of subjects. And what was discovered was that, stress measures, again, correlated with rank. The people that were the highest up in the British civil service reported that they really loved their jobs, didn't have that much stress. People that were lower on the hierarchy had far more.
Wow. Did they also do blood tests?
I mean, I'm not sure about that. I know they did a lot of interviews and self-reports on how people experienced their...
So what they reported was they felt worse.
Yes, absolutely.
More stressed.
Yeah.
They didn't have the job satisfaction that the higher people did.
Yes. And in the modern era, what we talk about there is control. How much control do you have?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the literature now looks at the highest stress jobs are the ones that have high psychological demand. Notice that key word, psychological. Pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the pressure come from? Usually from other people in your social world. You know, the boss expects X, Y, and Z, and you better have it ready by such and such and so on. So if you have high psychological demand, but low decision control, that's the formula for a high stress job.
If one can change their work so that they have more control, they might still be able to put out the work, but if they had some decision-making control over it, they would have less stress.
And this is where, and actually Robert Sapolsky uses this as an example, one way sort of out of this is you can become like the captain of the company softball team.
Mm-hmm.
So that creates a situation where you have more status and thereby counteract the other effects. Or you start looking at life in a bigger picture and don't identify so much with the position that has low control. So that you're finding other ways to feel more in, I'm going to use the word in charge.
Mm-hmm.
We just feel better and less stressed out when we feel like we have some control or decision over the situation.
You know, one of the things that we see, though, is people doing that at home instead of finding a positive way. They come home and they're totally jerks at home.
Well, absolutely. And that's very consistent with what's been observed in the baboon colonies, a pecking order thing.
Mm-hmm.
The boss picks on you. You pick on another subordinate. That employee goes home and kicks the dog or whatever.
The kids.
The
spouse.
Gets in an argument with the spouse.
Right.
Exactly. A trickle-down effect.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I suppose if one's having a day like that, there needs to be a little switch over before you get home to really have a much happier family.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, I think. And later on, we'll get into some things we can do to handle this stuff. But a researcher named Shidley in North Carolina has done some interesting studies with macaque monkeys, and her focus, her physiological measure, was atherosclerosis, or, you know, the fancy term for plaque buildup in our arteries, which, of course, as you know, as a healthcare professional yourself, it can be literally deadly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, same thing, the macaques tend to establish themselves in a dominant hierarchical kind of structure. So what she did was went ahead and looked at how much plaque buildup there was, and guess what?
Same thing.
Lower you were in the hierarchy, more plaque.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Huh.
So there's our second one. So we got, so clearly, you know, more stress hormones, and now we've got more plaque buildup. But it doesn't stop there. Turns out that there's actually brain cell loss and shrinkage, particularly in an area of the brain called the hippocampus. And I apologize for using some highfalutin terms today, but the hippocampus is known to be one of the primary memory centers in the brain. Particularly, it has to do with the transfer of short-term to long-term memory. So any kind of effect on the hippocampus is going to affect our memory and therefore probably our ability to access information we need for problem solving and such.
Let's take a break.
Okay.
Yeah, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call here at 503-325-0010. And you can ask a question of Patrick Prindle. He is a psychology professor, or I guess the psychology professor at Clatsop Community College. You're listening to Your Health, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldine, and I'm with Patrick Prindle, psychology professor at Clatsop Community College. And we're talking about the social and physiological aspects of stress. Okay, so we left on this really cool study.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is by Shidley. And some other researchers have also looked at, Shidley included, in terms of brain stuff. We're kind of looking at what's the impact on the brain. And I want, you know, Sapolsky was the first one to sort of hypothesize that perhaps stress could literally lead to brain damage. And, mm-hmm. you know, 30 years ago, that would have been a pretty controversial topic. Most physicians and stuff would have said, now give me a break.
I think today you would still have, by and large, the same response.
You think so?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that'll be one of our recommendations then, I think, is to get a more enlightened healthcare community.
I'm for that.
But at any rate, one of the other findings about these monkeys is that the ones lower in the hierarchy experienced a diminished happiness. The kind of thing that we see in depressed people who have what's called anhedonia. Anhedonia is a major symptom of depression that literally means the inability to experience joy. The sun isn't quite as bright. Your food doesn't taste quite as good. When your friend calls, you're not as excited about it. You're just not getting the joy you could. And it turns out that this is related to a neurotransmitter called dopamine. And dopamine is an excitatory neurotransmitter which enhances neural communication. And it turns out that it's important for our happiness in certain happiness centers of the brain that dopamine binds with receptor sites. In other words, you know what I mean? In terms of neurons, there are receptor sites that match up with certain neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. So in the pleasure areas of the brain, if this isn't happening, you just don't feel quite as happy. Mm-hmm. So guess what? Shidley and others have looked at. They've literally, because now we have the imaging technology to do this. So they can take pictures, moving pictures, literally of the high status monkeys and the low status monkeys in terms of these areas that light up or don't light up quite so brightly. And guess what? Same thing.
Wow.
Follows the pattern of rank. Lower rank, less pleasure, less lighting up, less dopamine receptor activity.
Hmm.
So far we've seen what? Increased stress hormones. We've seen atherosclerosis. We've seen literally the dying and negative impact on cells, particularly brain cells in the hippocampus, and now diminished pleasure because of dopamine receptor binding diminishment. So these are real, and I think the important thing here is this is not like somebody whining and complaining about stuff. This, you know, gosh, I feel really so bad. These are literally measurable scientific responses that are being documented by researchers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the next one. Here's the next physiological marker, and I know because you do some training and stuff on managing weight. But it turns out that stress and rank is also related to how we store fat. And this is also true of baboons and monkeys. So many people out there are probably familiar with the apple shape versus the pear shaped bodies. And most of us in the healthcare sector know that the apple shaped body correlates more with chronic kind of disorders and diseases. Things like what? Insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, and other things that go along with obesity. But it turns out that monkeys that are lower in rank tend to store more fat in their abdomen as compared to those in higher rank. And abdominal fat it's a different kind of fat that has to do with different hormone secretion.
It has to do with cortisol.
And it has to do with cortisol. There you go. are all glucocorticoids and cortisol and the stress hormones, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Which is the whole cascade of you can't sleep, you have more atherosclerosis, you're more stressed out, higher blood pressure,
you got
diabetes,
it.
The whole deal.
Yeah, we haven't talked about blood pressure and heart rate, but those are in there as well, and those have been clearly documented.
And they are the same?
Well, yeah, the rank correlates with all these physiological markers.
Whoa.
Hence the title, Social and Physiological Aspects, because I think for most people, we don't kind of inherently put those two together.
Mm-mm.
That, you know, the way we live socially or our rank socially might correlate with all these physiological markers, but indeed they do. Yeah.
That's pretty profound.
I think so, too.
So everyone needs to be the chief.
Well,
right?
Well, in a sense, we need to find ways to feel as though we're making some decisions, that our mm-hmm. life is our own to live,
mm-hmm.
and to create a society that in fact encourages and supports that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say a society that encourages flourishing, individuals that flourish.
Okay.
And find happiness and contentment and lowered stress. Yeah.
I think that sounds good.
So, then, you know, and I'm not probably going to have time to go through all these things in detail, but there have also been some studies that, particularly the Dutch hunger study, turns out in Holland in the 1944 with the Nazi occupation, there was a winter there when people were pretty much in starvation mode.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the Dutch researchers have gone in because they keep such good records in the health department there, and were able to find thousands and thousands of documented cases of women who got pregnant during that winter. And so later, literally when these then fetuses are now adults in their 60s, and there's still some footprint, so to speak, from their life as a fetus when their moms were in starvation mode, that tend to, you know, really put them in a situation where they're more susceptible to, you know, chronic stress disorders like high blood pressure, and
as opposed to people that were born at the same time that were properly nourished, or how do they compare?
Yeah, they could. Well, they literally, it was pretty easy. What they did is they compared the fetuses from that winter to fetuses before and fetuses following, and
got
found
it.
Some pretty dramatic differences.
Uh-huh.
So isn't that kind of interesting? In other words, if you're stressed out as a fetus because of the stress your mom's undergoing, turns out that could have lifelong impact on you.
And we certainly see it with fetal alcohol, drugs, and
absolutely.
It's like you can never overcome the damage that occurred when you were in utero.
Absolutely.
Huh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Are we ready to talk about?
We're getting close.
Okay.
I want to refer to some research that's been done by Elizabeth Blackburn and Alyssa Eppel. And this is stuff that was done in California around what I refer to as special needs moms. Turns out they found a cohort of moms who were getting together in a group who all had kids that had special needs.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that is a chronic stressor. You know, when I teach psych of human relations, one of the things we look at is happiness ratings during the course of marriage. And what we find is happiness ratings are higher in the beginning and toward the end and lower in the middle. And the reason for that is kids. So if you've got a special needs kid, then the stress is even more. And so what was discovered there is that these protective little caps on the ends of our chromosomes called telomeres, which tend to erode with aging, they tended to erode faster with these women that were subjected to this chronic stress. And then Blackburn discovered an enzyme that apparently helps and named this thing telomerase. And turns out that apparently it is secreted more when people engage in affiliative. Affiliation means kind of hanging out, nurturing,
supporting
each other. Like
their support group.
Like the support group, exactly. That tends to, what, minimize the impact of this damage being done to the tips of the chromosomes.
Whoa, Lloyd, does that make the case for having support and getting together with people instead of being isolated?
Absolutely. And what happens is Sapolsky finds that his troop, the original troop that he studied of baboons, had actually made the mistake of feeding at a popular area where tourists and stuff would stay in Kenya, and they ate some infected meat, TB-infected meat, and a huge number of the troop died. And guess who died? The alpha males. Probably because they were more aggressive and therefore ate more of the meat and stuff. But the interesting thing is that the troop was left with twice as many females as males, and the males that were left were not high dominant males, so they therefore tended to be more affiliative. So then what happens is other adolescent baboons from other colonies who typically run off on their own and try to get into a new colony and establish themselves, mm-hmm. when they would show up, little brats that they are, you know, they fairly quickly adapted to the new social norms in that baboon colony. And so 20 years later, this baboon colony is now what? Less stressed out, more relaxed. You don't have all that alpha behavior, and you don't have as much pecking order. So you have a much, literally, stress-lowering kind of social structure.
That's pretty cool.
Very cool.
It's amazing. I mean, it's really a shame that they had exposure to, of course, to people that killed off their alpha males. But it's interesting to have that time perspective.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, to sort of give you a recommendation based on the research is that, what? A, it's pretty clear at a physiological level that the way we set up our society has an impact on us as individuals. And so we need to move in the direction of, in the things that I think of, the terms I think of are support, affiliation, reciprocal caring, mm-hmm. Compassion, you know, generosity, helping others, all those kind of things are definitely the way we ought to be headed in terms of how we set up our social structure.
That sounds excellent. All right. Yeah. So let's see, in specifics. Let's go to some real, just take a look at that.
Okay.
Some specific things would be, it sounds like, find people to hang out with that are supportive of you.
Sorry, one more time.
Find people that are supportive. Hang out with people that support you.
Absolutely. And give support. Helping others is good for you. Get you out of your own stuff.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times when people are feeling bad, they isolate themselves. And they're sort of caught in their own world. I mean, I was working out with a guy yesterday. He was like, oh, I feel so bad. I feel sad. I don't know what to do. I'm dragging.
Yeah.
And I suggested something that you had suggested in a previous program, which was, why don't you look at someone who's in worse shape than you and help them out? And he thought that was really revolutionary.
Well, there you go.
And that seemed like a good thing. And it brightened him up. It made him feel better. And he thought, okay, let's see. Who could I think of?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there's always look south. I mean, Haiti, you know, what could you do there?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I noticed apparently one of our callers made a comment that developing a strong center core is more important than one's pecking order or society's perceptions. And don't underestimate the spiritual dimension. And I couldn't agree more. That's in there. In fact, I would say that ultimately the solution to this whole problem is consciousness. So on the inside, so to the outside, so as more and more people, I'm really happy to see this comment from this caller that, you know, the more and more folks that develop their consciousness and become more caring and affiliative and supportive and helping others and all those good things.
And also helping themselves.
And helping themselves, mm-hmm. absolutely. And how do you get that way? You get that way through committing to becoming a more spiritual person. Finding things that are sacred.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So finding meaning.
Finding meaning.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
And also humor.
Uh-huh.
Never underestimate the power of humor.
Good point.
Yeah.
Final words?
Final words. Stress is real. The impact on your body is real. And there are some clearly validated ways that we want to proceed in order to minimize its impact.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome very much.
It's been a pleasure having you. My guest has been Patrick Prindle. He is a psychology professor at Clatsop Community College. And thank you to the college for letting him come repeatedly here and be with us. Next week, join me for Digging the Dirt, where Sean Hogan will be my guest. He is the owner of Sistis Nursery on Sovies Island and is a big fan of all things tropical and awesome and also what does well natively. He talked with us a few years ago about Echo Roofs in Portland and how miserably they were doing, how they were all dying because it's a drought place. And have a great week. And you can call Kate Brister at 325-0010.